You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Thank you so much for coming. We're really excited to host Landessa for the brown bag entitled Fueling Economic Advancement and Empowerment Through Land Rights. I'm going to turn it over to the CEO of Soros Economic Development Fund and Director of the Economic Advancement Program, Sean Hinton, who's going to give us an introduction.
Wow. Thank you, Blair. That was something. It gets more formal every time. Blair's my assistant. We know each other very well. Anyway, it's really a great pleasure. We are doing more and more of these brown bags, and I'm finding them just for my own thinking and my own work here so stimulating to have the opportunity to engage with and to really hear the discussions that come out from these brown bags. The best thing for me is to sit back and listen to you all having a dialogue with the various people that have been able to join us, and I'm thrilled to have Tim and Chris here from Landessa. I think everybody knows that as we've been developing the EAP strategy, we are defining economic advancement as distinct from just economic development, as a focus on the intersection between economic activity and the social justice outcomes that we care about at the Open Society. What is the interaction between, you know, equality of political voice and economic equality or inequality? What are the intersections between various aspects of rights and the role of the private sector? How do we deal with rights and responsibilities across the social justice and economic development that divide? And increasingly looking to focus our work not purely on the more generic measures of economic development, but to look at this meeting point, at this intersection. Now, what Landessa do in their work with land rights has huge consequences for economic outcomes for, you know, I don't know, the majority of people on the planet. And I have known of and have been tracking the work that Landessa have done for many years. I'm not going to try and introduce Tim and Chris or really the work of Landessa in any more detail. I want to give them the sort of maximum time possible, and so I'll hand over. But just to say, I'm really thrilled that we can have this. We haven't got any practical collaboration yet with Landessa with our own program. We haven't figured out where that will be. Today's part of that exploration, and we're very interested in hearing the response and the sort of engagement that you all have with them and with the work that they've done. And many of you may know and be working with them already much more than we are. But I thought we'd steal this opportunity to sort of start that conversation. And thank you for taking the time and coming.
Great. Well, first, thanks for having us. Wonderful to be here. I've had a chance to talk to a lot of different folks inside OSF, but it's nice to have a group of people around the table to discuss these issues. And we will try to be fairly quick, although we do ramble a little bit, because it really would be helpful to hear from others and create a little bit of a discussion. But I'm going to start with a little bit of an overview, and then Tim's going to do the substantive stuff, because Tim knows this, having worked at Landessa long before I even knew about Landessa. My own background, which is somewhat relevant to the conversation, is I'm a lawyer. I got into this area of development and human rights early on. I was very interested in poverty. I had worked in Africa before law school and tried to combine development with human rights, and discovered in the early 90s that there was really nothing going on in that area. You had the development folks that didn't talk about human rights and the human rights groups that didn't care about poverty. And my friends and I tried to start a little operation called the Center for Economic and Social Rights to fill this gap in a small way in the human rights field. And so I worked for 10 years on economic and social rights issues, a lot of time in Latin America, and with a specific focus for much of that on indigenous peoples and extractive industries. And I quickly discovered that my human rights training was not well suited to the kind of work I was doing, which was targeting these large economic actors, both private and World Bank and IFI and the rest, and really with no understanding of what was going on inside those institutions. So I went to Wall Street and worked for 4 years trying to get to understand them, and then decided that the real action in the development space was going to be on private sector engagement. So I joined Oxfam just as they were starting a private sector team and helped them build that up. That's where John and I worked for many years together, building up the private sector work of Oxfam, which was a fascinating effort because Oxfam also had taken a similar journey, first development, then realized it needed to touch on human rights and advocacy, and then realized economic actors were front and center and they needed a strategy to deal with these actors. So Oxfam has been, over the last 10 years or so, trying to figure out how do we engage markets in a way that leads to better outcomes for people living in poverty. And that, and I got a big dose of that. And towards the end of that work, I came to see land as sort of central to almost everything that I had been doing over the prior 25 years. It was certainly a big issue with indigenous peoples. It's big with all our all of Oxfam's work on humanitarian issues. It was big on the development front with farmers and others. And then in the final campaign that we worked on behind the brands, which John and I worked very closely on, a lot of that campaigning also focused on land grabs. And I came to know Landessa, and I realized that land has been sort of central to what I've been doing, and there was an opportunity there, so I jumped over to Landessa. Now, Landessa, I thought I knew something about land rights when I joined Landessa, because I had been working, as I say, for about 25 years, but really there was a whole set of issues that Landessa had been working on that I was completely unfamiliar with. And it struck me that there's almost two worlds out there that both consider themselves working around land rights. There's the land grab crowd that works on conflict and raising alarms around people getting removed from their land and expropriations and the like. And that's where Oxfam and Human Rights Watch and Global Witness and Earth Rights and all of the others tend to work. And then there's this whole other community of folks that work upstream and are thinking about those millions of people that live in a perpetual state of insecurity and how that impacts their lives. And that's where Landessa has been for the last 50 years. And so I've had to really sort of ramp up around this whole other set of issues that has to do with land rights outside of the spotlight of land grabs, but really more about how do we bring more security to folks on land as a gateway to everything else that we're trying to do on development. And I quickly came to realize just how central land is to almost everything, to women's rights, to the environment, to conflict, to economic growth, to livelihoods. And I've really, in my first year at Landessa, it has been a steep learning curve. And that one of the things I've been struck with has been that the fact that there is still this somewhat of a siloed world out there between the land grabbers or folks working on that and the folks working more on the land insecurity generally. And it's also been an education on another way of working. So I come out of a human rights perspective. We always treat governments cynically as part of the problem. And we're out to really build countervailing power and try to take them on. At Landessa, it's been just the opposite. It's really been trying to find the low-hanging fruit, all of those governments that are actually, or all of those champions inside governments who actually have a very good reason to do the right thing, but don't have the tools or the experience or the capacity. And Landessa has found, working with now over 50 governments, that there are a lot of governments that really do want to do the right thing on land, and that we can actually affect huge transformation at scale by working with those governments to try to steer them in the right direction around land rights. And this is what Tim will talk a bit about. But then alongside that, we've also come to see that that's just the first step, that really the implementation side of it is so much, in many ways, messier and more challenging. You can get a great law passed, but if it's not being implemented, it doesn't do much good for the people. And often these laws face all kinds of challenges once they're on the books. And so Landessa, sort of, you could group our work into two spheres. One is the legal reform, and the other is all of this innovative work on the ground with partners. Sometimes those are civil society groups. Sometimes they are communities themselves, paralegals. Sometimes they're universities. And sometimes they are local government officials on the ground who are also just struggling to do the right thing. And Landessa tries to provide tools for them as well. And those implementation challenges, I think, is where we may see ourselves working with many of the same groups that OSF has been funding and working with. And then finally, I'll say my last insight has just been the centrality of land, as I said, to almost everything. And that if you get land right, a lot of other things can build themselves out of that. And if you don't get it right, so many of our efforts on the humanitarian side, on the development side, on the legal empowerment and women's rights side and human rights side are bound to fail. And I have really come to see land as that gateway or building block for almost everything else we do. And so it's really, I feel like I've lucked in some ways to the perfect position at the perfect time when many of these other communities, the human rights crowd, the housing rights, the climate change, are sort of coming around to land also. And so it's a really interesting time in some ways to be in a land rights outfit like Landesa. Okay, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tim, who will show you a little bit more about the substantive side of what we actually do at Landesa.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here. A quick introduction of myself first. I'm also a lawyer. I've been doing land rights work now for 30 years. I started doing it as a faculty member at the University of Washington Law School, where I joined a professor who had been doing this work for 20 years previously, and a few years later, about 25 years ago, then took the work outside of the university framework and into this NGO, which now is Landesa. Was the CEO for some time, and as the organization grew from two people to over 100, realized that, I realized it long before then, that I'd never really aspired to lead an organization, and I was really wanting to get back more into the deep into the program work, and particularly living overseas doing that, and that led to a process which eventually had us hiring Chris, and it's been great working with him over the last year, and a little bit more than that, plus actually before he came on board. I'm now based in India, at least temporarily. So that's a little bit about myself. So to get into land rights, Landesa didn't, its origins are really about working on the issues of poverty and conflict around the planet. And it was actually trying to figure out a way in which we could address issues of poverty and conflict from a more structural perspective that led us to the issue of land. Let's go. So 3/4 of the world's poorest people live in rural areas. So if we're going to look at the issue of poverty, that led us to the issue of rural areas. And then why to land is because in rural areas, land is the most important asset. Mm-hmm. Land is the most important source of income, of food, of wealth, of power, of status, of access to government entitlements. And if you were to sum it up, I think it's fair to say that one's access to social and economic opportunity for the rural poor is largely connected to one's relationship to land, access and rights to land. Now, if we look around the world, we can see that more than a billion rural poor people who rely on land for their livelihoods actually lack secure legal rights to land. It's a very large number. And it falls into three broad categories. The first category are families, men and women, and their children, who are absolutely landless. So these are people who, if you ask them, do you have land of your own, they would tell you no. And including house site land, farmland, forest land, grassland, other categories of rural land. That category of the three categories tends to be the poorest. They tend to, most of them tend to get their primary source of income from agricultural wage labor. Many of them stuck in feudal or semi-feudal relationships with the people they work for. The second category are families that actually possess land but lack secure legal rights to that land. That's a larger category. And if you look at that category, again, you can further divide it into house sites, into agricultural land, into forest land, into grassland. And that land you could also divide into two broad categories of either private land or publicly owned land. There's yet a third category, and these are, in both the first category and the second category, there are men and women in both categories. In the third category is exclusively women living in families where males in those families have secure legal rights to land, but they don't share in those legal rights. So Landessa, as we look at those categories of people that we ultimately want to provide opportunity to, we have to think about them differently because the problems and thus then the solutions are different for those three categories. And also because of that, we have a particular focus on women. And it's not just because of that third category. It's also because even in the first two categories, we have found over time that if you don't have a very specific focus on making sure that when a household gets rights to land, that women share in those rights, if you miss that opportunity when rights are first granted, it's very, very, it's much more difficult to then change that later. So what happens when people in those categories who have been landless get secure legal rights to land? And there is a growing body of literature that looks at the impacts at the household or at the micro level, let's say, of what those impacts are. And this is an infographic that actually each one of these points is captured by at least one specific study that is cited at the bottom of that. And we'll, of course, share this short deck with you. But just to provide an overview, there are studies showing that agricultural production goes up by 60%, that incomes go up, studies showing that by 150%. Land values themselves, and this is something often I think that we miss in the development space. We tend to, even in looking at the economic side of the equation, we tend to focus, I think, more on income than on wealth, and wealth often is, many times I would say, more important than income. But land that has clarified secure legal rights to it is worth much more than when that is absent. There are studies showing that secure legal land rights lead to higher high school graduation rates for children, up to 2 times higher, increases the numbers of hours worked because you don't have to defend your rights by staying on the land. Teenage pregnancy in households that have secure legal rights going down by half. So a lot of good things potentially can happen when typically do happen when households get secure legal rights to land. When women share in those secure legal rights to land, even more good things happen. So again, even a faster growing body of literature around this showing that women, one study showing that women earned 3.8 times more when they share in legal rights to land, that when women share on legal rights to land, they then get more voice over how the income that the family gained is spent. And when women have more voice in that income, as you're all probably aware, more of that income does go into investing in the children's education and nutrition in documented ways. That domestic violence for women when they share in the rights to the homes, in particular the house sites, there's a study in India showing that women who share in those rights are 8 times less likely to experience domestic violence. Women's savings rates go up. So all kinds of great documented impacts at the micro level. We don't have an infographic on this, but it's also, I think, important to mention there's lots of studies now looking at the macro level, that what happens at a societal level, or on these, the studies are not, they can't show causal relationships, they show associative relationships. But you do see very clear relationships between economic growth rates, you see clear relationships between the growth of democratic institutions, you see associations between the growth levels of conflict and crime. That is essentially as a predictor, if land rights in a given society are both more egalitarianly spread and more secure, you find better outcomes. So that then might lead to the question, okay, why? Why, if we see all of these great relationships, why don't more of these more than 1 billion people have secure legal rights to land? And in looking at that, as we look at it broadly, say there's two categories of barriers. The first category is law and policy gaps. And this is the area where Landesa in its early years largely focused, is how do we close those, what are those law and policy gaps? How do we identify those through initially research, both desk research and a lot of field research, and then developing recommendations for governments and advocating for those governments in the way that Chris talked about. That a big part of that is creating positive working relationships with government, coming to them not in a public naming and shaming kind of way, but in a, here's what the research shows, here's the benefits that you might accrue if you actually were able to make these changes, and here are some specific areas that we've identified of laws that can be changed or new laws that can be added or policies or large-scale government programs. And for our first number of decades, this was the primary area of focus for Landesa. Over the last 10 years, 10 to 15 years, we've gotten more into this second area, and that is recognizing that changes in law and policy are almost always necessary, but almost never sufficient. And so what are the barriers on the implementation side? And what can Landesa and other civil society actors do to help address those barriers? And those, there's a subset of constraints there, and lack of awareness of both right holders, so both on the demand side and then on the supply side of the government in terms of those who are charged with administering or giving the rights in the first place. There's often a lack of government capacity, lack of political will, and then particularly around the area of women's land rights, these patriarchal social norms are a huge, huge obstacle. And so over the last 10 to 15 years, we've gotten more involved in how can we work with both government partners but also civil society partners in addressing these implementation obstacles. This slide tries to capture the approach generally that we use, Landesa uses in our work at the country level. By the way, I haven't mentioned also where we work. Chris mentioned, I think, earlier that we have worked
on the next slide.
Oh, okay, that's coming. Thanks, Chris. So we start with research. We then go to design that is using the research findings. And a lot of this research, often we're working with host country national research organizations and individuals to identify what are those policy constraints. And using the findings then to design and review changes needed at the policy and legislative level. We then take those recommendations and work in a kind of a multi-stakeholder approach, but trying to get the governments to look at them and often try and framing our advocacy in ways or which align with government's existing incentives. And as Chris mentioned, the governments often want to do the right thing for a variety of reasons. Often it's because the organizations that have that come more with the stick approach or the naming and blaming approach actually create that political will. Often governments will be under threat from rural insurgencies, and that creates a political will. And there's a variety of reasons why they may want to change these things. To attract foreign direct investment may be another reason. And then if we are able to get policy changes made, or if or if recent policy changes have been made, maybe that we weren't involved with, we often then go in and look at what are the implementation obstacles and work with government. And now, what does that look like? It's things like promoting legal awareness, actually working hand in hand with governments around piloting things, setting up monitoring systems with often the government. So there's a variety of things within the implementation side. So where do we work? Our work now at the country level is largely confined to Asia and Africa. Within Asia, India, China, and Myanmar. Within Africa, we are currently working in Ghana and Tanzania. We have project-level work, or recently had project-level work, in Rwanda, Ethiopia, Uganda, Kenya, Liberia, Malawi. I may have missed a couple of others. But the work is not all the same across all of these places. In some places, like in China, it's much more focused at the policy level, working closely with the government. Doing a lot of research on the ground and feeding them that information up. In India, there's some of that policy level work. Actually, it's quite a bit of it, but there's also even more implementation work, working with the government. As a result, we have a lot more people in India. Also in India, the land is largely a state subject, so it varies. I mean, you really have to be working at the state level to make this work well. In Myanmar, where our work is fairly new, just over the last recent few years, we are working closely, had been working closely earlier with both the government and the opposition on the national land policy, and in building capacity at the senior most government levels, actually including things like taking ministers to other countries to do like learning visits. Just a lot of training of government officials. And then in Africa, it's mostly been project-level work, some of it policy-related, some of it implementation of policy-related, and we haven't yet, it's only in very recent years that we were focusing in on, particularly initially Ghana and Tanzania, and setting up country offices there to take a kind of more long-term bet or creating those boots on the ground.
What made you choose Ghana and Tanzania over the 48 odd ones other?
Yeah, there's a long answer to that, but the short answer is we've actually developed a set of criteria that helps us decide what countries to focus in, and the criteria look at a number of issues, including what is the potential the size of the potential beneficiary universe. We look at are there certain preconditions present in terms of level of rule of law and of lack of conflict? Is it a weak or failed state? We're less likely to go in. To what extent are there, will our value add be more significant? That is where what we can bring is, yeah. And also in terms of when we put boots on the ground, to what extent is what is the attitude or the environment in terms of setting up a nonprofit presence in that country?
Tanzania, I have to say, it's a bit surprising. Ghana, I get more because the government there is very, very protective, very socialist, and I try to do a lot of projects in my previous life in Tanzania, and I have to say, I never managed, so it's quite frustrating.
Well, we should talk. It's early days for us, so we'll see if it ends up being the right bet on that fact.
But you're working in India and China, neither of which are renowned to be easy places
exactly.
to operate.
Yeah.
Ethiopia.
And Ethiopia.
Yeah.
I tell you, our early work in these countries, for actually in China and India, has been very entrepreneurial, and we were working in certainly in legal gray space, to put it kindly, for a long time in those places. And when we were younger and kind of smaller, there was also more appetite for that. You know, as you grow larger and develop a larger brand and all of that, it becomes a bit more difficult. So these are things we're grappling with now.
So Ethiopia also includes work with the Africa Union, which has also been a big part of what we've been doing.
Right. The Africa Union has a land policy initiative that we are working closely with. That's working with African Union member states to actually help them develop better land policies.
So final slide, and then we'll go to a question and answer. So this is just to give you a sense of where we're headed. Much of what Tim has been talking about, we have four pillars in our five-year strategic plan. Much of what Tim has been talking about is that first one, the policy reform and implementation. Alongside that, we have a Women's Land Rights Center, which is very active. It helps inform all of our work, but also does trainings, does research. We have a program where we bring government and civil society leaders for 6 weeks a year to train them on land rights and build capacity. Then the third bucket is trying to engage more at the global level with new constituencies who we believe will be champions for land. So we're increasingly seeing the development community come around to land, the women's rights community, human rights folks. We're just coming from Human Rights Watch now, the housing rights folks. So there's we sense that there is movement around land. Land made its way into the SDGs, three different goals now include land rights, and that's totally new. The UN has come around in many ways and has set up new norms. So we see a lot of energy at the global movement, and we want to increasingly engage with that. And then the fourth category, where we also see a lot of opportunity, is with the private sector, the large ag companies, the extractives, the investors, the banks. There's a real hunger for guidance around land rights, and we are working with a number of companies, but we are also developing guidance documents for companies and for investors, which we hope will be a contribution to that space. So those are the four pillars of our work. And I think across all of it, just as a closer and to open up a discussion, I see so much potential for collaborating with OSF. I have to say, every time I get to know a little bit more about OSF, I see land as a potential point of collaboration for us. And just the name Open Society, as Tim was saying, are based in many cases on people feeling secure about their land rights. It was only the landholders that had the right to vote in many countries, still in many communities. If you don't have secure land rights, you're not a member of the tribal council or the political body that governs. So land is central on the political side. It's also so central on all of these different economic and social issues. So I'm really hopeful that we will find ways to collaborate with you folks. And thanks for the chance. So with that, let's just open up a little and see what people are, where you guys are seeing.
I have a question. Maybe two questions. One on collaboration. Are you working in any of these countries with other organizations that are involved with land rights? That's the first. And the second is, how do you see technology playing a role in the land rights issues in the countries where you're working?
So Tim, maybe you go for both of those. One thing Tim elided a little bit, but what it was a slide, is we do increasing work around legal empowerment. So we know that NAMADI, for example, we're collaborating with in Myanmar, and we work with groups. On the implementation side in particular, we work with, our work depends entirely on working with partners in both civil society and government. So we have quite a bit of collaboration with partners, and I'm sure beyond NAMADI there must be other OSF grantees or partners. But Tim, maybe you want to answer both of those.
Yeah, well, on the first one, the answer is yes, and we work with local research organizations, so think tanks. We work with local NGOs or federations of NGOs in many of the countries where we're working. There already is some existing almost federation that sometimes devoted specifically to land rights, mm-hmm. Rights alliances. Yes, very much so. Okay. We find ourselves sometimes, though, in working with those local partners, it can be a bit tricky because our approach requires, for us to be effective, we have to have very close relationships with the government. And sometimes our NGO partners there have a very different relationship with the government, and so kind of working with them and managing that is a challenge, but I think we've, in most places, we've found a very good way to do it. On the technology question, it's a great question, and we don't have high technology competency, I would say, within Landesa, but we increasingly are exploring that, and we have a couple of projects, one with Google.org and in India, and we're exploring also with an NGO called Cadasta.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of. I'll just point to one specific area. So one of the reasons why people are sitting on land that they don't have secure legal rights to is that land is claimed by the government just broadly, you know, in the law, and the government has never actually taken the step to go in and to document who's sitting on that and essentially formalize what are socially legitimate rights. And that process of formalization is something that we're trying to give tools to the government that a way that they can do it and do it in a way that's community-led and that protects the marginalized groups within that community. Because that formalization, I would argue, actually needs to happen everywhere,
yeah.
Eventually. But there's also, it has massive benefits, but also has massive risks if it's not done well, because massive risks around elite capture.
Yeah.
So using technology and doing that, can help speed up that process, both in gathering the information, georeferencing the information, analyzing the information, and then integrating it into the government records.
Thank you.
I will also say that blockchain now is becoming a sort of a hot topic amongst the land rights community. We haven't started working with it, but some others are pushing it. And the use of drones, as Tim was suggesting, is also another big one, where we've just, you know, been we're sort of on the margins trying to figure out where we can find something helpful to our work.
I had a question about actually like customary law and like plural legal systems. You see a lot of places where, you know, women's inheritance rights, for example, are very limited by certain customary laws, and often these are not really documented in the same way. So you were talking about working a lot on sort of national level or state level policy. Like, do you encounter these kinds of systems? And if so, you know, what is your approach? How do you address that?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Absolutely do we encounter them. Absolutely we encounter them, because I would argue they exist everywhere. I mean, they're... I think looking at systems as a binary between customary and formal actually is leads us in the wrong direction. Every system is some combination of formal and customary. I could go to the legal property rights sitting in this room right here. There are customary rights here. So a lot of the issues, though, of framing it, it's not that looking at customary as different than formal is a wrong way of looking at it, but oftentimes the formal statutory rights, there's a big gap between what's statutory and what's customary, and then is how do you close that gap? And that takes both changes sometimes in statutory, but also changes in social norms that impacts the customary. I realize I'm not providing specifics, because the specifics are different in every setting, but closing that gap between those two is really important. And one way of thinking about it is that in order for land rights to be truly secure, they have to be both socially and legally legitimate. And you can frame a 2x2 where you'd say socially legitimate, not socially legitimate, legally legitimate, not legally legitimate, and you could, every land tenure system you could put somewhere in there, and you want to move the systems to that box where they're both formally and statutorily or legally and socially legitimate.
But to add a little bit of specifics, we do work on that challenge, and where we have had a little bit of luck, I mean, that's a challenge that confronts all kinds of work, not just land, right? I mean, that's a challenge for everybody that works on some kind of legal piece. In some cases, we have found that bringing the constitutional reforms bring the traditional systems within the formal system, at least by law. So it recognizes these tribal authorities. And at the same time, imposes certain more progressive rights, like women's rights. And so Landesa has, in certain pilots, worked with communities, women's groups, and tribal authorities to identify those kind of gaps that Tim mentions, where the tribal authorities have been empowered by the Constitution or by the statutory regime, but that also means that they now have to start recognizing women's rights in particular. And those pilots actually have been quite successful. We've done that work in Kenya in particular. I'm not sure if we did some of that in Rwanda, but at least in Kenya. And I think it's going to be, it at least points to one direction to a challenge that confronts people across the world. And it's been, we hope to be able to expand on that work in other places. So that's been one effort to try to do it. But it is that bridging of the two systems, as Tim mentions. Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how your work, if at all, has intersected with rural farmers of crops declared illicit. So in our own program, the Global Drug Policy Program, our portfolio in what we're sort of calling the supply side, development side, has grown. And one of the issues we're quite interested in is the nexus between land and drugs, because particularly for the most poor rural producers of illicit crops, they tend to be land poor or landless, and then it's sort of there are compounding problems with, say, eradication, that then the crops they're growing on land that's not theirs is eradicated, pushing them further into virgin forest and becoming more dependent on illicit crops, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a big cycle there, and the drug policy community has sort of been interested in this space, but I think for the land, our experience a bit is that for the land rights community or the development community, they've got their hands full with so many other problems that you add illicit drugs production on top of that, and it's kind of like, look, that's in government dialogue to say that, like, producers of illicit crops should also have land rights as a precondition for assistance to help them move from dependence on illicit cultivation to licit cultivation. So I'm just curious, in your work, where are you at with that? And are you seeing a conversation here developing in the land rights community? And is this a place where perhaps our interests and your interests could, particularly I think about Myanmar, but we also face this in Afghanistan or Colombia or Mexico.
That's a fascinating question. We have not looked at it or worked at it, so it would be really interesting to follow this up with an offline conversation, because a working hypothesis, which I've seen some evidence for out in the field, is that people with insecure legal rights have a higher incentive, or at least less of a threat, in growing illicit crops because they have less to lose if they get caught. But we haven't looked at it systematically, and it would be a fascinating area to look at.
Yeah, I would love that also. And we do, of course, as you said, we're heavy into Myanmar right now, and so there it's very relevant. And we were doing some work in Colombia, so there could also be relevant. So we'd love to explore that. And as Tim says, one of the arguments that we make, both to governments and civil society, is that if you give communities their secure rights, that will help on the deforestation front. They become less prone to sort of short-term scavenging or whatever it is. By the same token, I would imagine there's a very strong argument you can make to governments that if you secure their rights, they're going to be less prone to these other things. I haven't seen that argument. Maybe you have, but that would be something that we'd be very interested in exploring.
Yeah, I'd be happy to chat more.
Absolutely. Okay. I'm actually very interested in looking at the link of economic empowerment of communities and securing their land rights. Because late last month, we went to Kenya and we had like all these groups from Asia and Africa discussing litigation on indigenous people's land rights. Mm. And in the process, as she mentioned, some of the challenges that we had was documentation and evidence gathering in proving that a community under customary ownership actually should be entitled to particular land. And we noticed also that most states were reluctant to use
for instance, scholarly articles of Western scholars. So they would say, oh yeah, that is good, we could pay attention to it, but no, that is not a native, that's not a Kenyan who has produced mm-hmm. that particular report. Mm-hmm. So those were some of the challenges. Then we also, some conclusions were drawn, for instance, that communities, it is better for communities to be at the forefront for advocating for their land rights. So, and then we discovered also that communities that were economically empowered had their own financial base and were able to push for litigation and also receive successful results, because they didn't have to, because governments would say, oh, it's a Western organization pushing for a Western agenda if they are funding actually litigation for a particular group of people. So that's why I'm very interested in knowing about that. Have you also experienced that economically empowered communities were in a better position to advocate for their own rights?
Yes, we have. Your question, actually, it's a fascinating question, and points to a number of really important issues, including the issue between group rights or community rights and individual rights. Between and of international actors and local actors. But yes, more economically empowered communities are often in a better position. The problem in many places is that if at least the broad legal framework doesn't create some direction or framework for communities to gain their group rights, and it's just kind of on a community-by-community basis, it's really challenging. I mean, you'll have some that do it well and others who don't. So creating that at least broad legal framework, I think, is at the national or subnational level, is really important. And although you didn't ask the question of, you know, which is often asked in these types of situations, is it group right? Do you push for individual rights or do you push for group rights? It's that also is a kind of a false choice. In every situation, I think it has to be both. It's never completely either or, and it has to be some combination. And often, when a community's rights, whether it's indigenous group or just a local community that's not indigenous, it's often sequential that you'll want to at least protect, that is, put a legal fence around the community's rights and then allow the community itself, or create a framework of rules where the community can dictate, allocate allocation and use rights within the community. So I didn't specifically answer your question, but yeah, definitely communities that are more economic empowered have a better chance to do it. And the key is actually to try to create a legal and a capacity framework, institutional framework, where it doesn't necessarily depend on just the community's economic power.
Blair, can I suggest we just open up the phone
to
the UK or Dakar in case it is? I know the EAP team, we're going to have a little bit more time with you guys afterwards, but did anyone on the phone want to come in with a question?
Yeah, this is Tim Wise. I'm a former fellow working in the food security and climate change program, and currently doing consulting with Open Society in Africa. And I was really curious if you had, you know, the debate that you guys seem to be in the center of in some of these countries and societies and governments is over where is sort of that fine line between privatizing land that facilitates its alienation in the worst case scenarios, with those situations where documenting land rights facilitates community empowerment. And I wondered if you had kind of best practice recommendations about how to dance that fine line, like where it becomes dangerous to just document individual land rights.
So
Yeah. So it's about transferability. To what extent, when people talk about privatization, they're often at least talking about to what extent people get full ability to transfer their rights to anyone they want to, and in different ways that they want to. It's how to say it. We talk about appropriate transferability, that actually you want to move to some levels of transferability. You have to do it. You have to look at what are the objectives within a given system, and what are the dangers, and kind of design it that way. Design it to meet the needs of it. And it may be different also for different types of land. For environmentally fragile land, it may be very different than for house site land. In fact, it's likely to be very different. So it's rather complex, but again, it's not a binary. It shouldn't be either that land shouldn't be transferable, or that all land should be fully transferable. And it actually almost never is. But gradually, as economies develop, I would argue that you need to move towards greater transferability and in different ways, while at the same time protecting the marginalized who might have their rights taken advantage of them if you go there too quickly. That's a very broad way of framing it, but it's, if you ask the question, for example, in a society, if you can't transfer the rights, when countries are developing, you can almost be sure that you will have over time a movement of the labor force and population out of agriculture into other sectors, out of rural areas into urban areas. And if they don't have a way to transfer their rights, how is that going to happen? The government has to go in and do it, as they are doing it in China, which with disastrous results. It actually gives the government more power. So you have to allow for that, I think, private transfer of rights. It's how you do it and how quickly is the key question.
Great. Sorry, I do think that we have to cut it off there, Tim and Chris will be around for a little while today, so maybe we can connect you afterwards. Thank you all so much for coming. Those on the phone, thank you so much for dialing in. I think we can all say that this is a very enlightening and educational conversation, and your work sounds fascinating. So thank you so much for joining us. And we have the pleasure of speaking to you further after this, so that's very exciting.
And thank you
all so very much.
Thank you, Blair, for coordinating.
Thank you.